IsraelScene.com.
You're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram, down from the high country, the high city.
In very, very hot Tel Aviv.
Truly, that's why we're in the air conditioning.
She's not supposed to say.
I'm not, I'm sorry.
No.
Is that all right? This has really been a very heartbreaking week, 10 days, the prisoner exchange, or the non-prisoner exchange, and everything surrounding it really seems to be a very depressing and disgusting expression of the reality that we're living in.
What's disgusting?
Well, it's disgusting that the people that we're in conflict with are so ghoulish as to have stolen dead bodies. That's really what happened. I mean, we talk about kidnapping, we talk about abduction, but the real thing is they stole dead bodies, and we were so inept and so desperate that we allowed ourselves to be taken advantage of, or we invited ourselves to be taken advantage of, in a way that is repulsive to me personally, certainly, and to some other people in this country, I think. Although I think you were the one who said that there were more people, non-Israelis, who are upset by it than Israelis, which is also kind of a sad story of where we're at. And I felt very strongly that this was a victory for sentimentality rather than for rationality and for hard thinking and hard choices, which I think is what is required of us in order to survive here. I think it's what we had to offer in order to establish our foothold here.
And if nothing more, to allow those two families have completion with knowing that their sons are both dead and they can put it to rest and get on with their lives as best as anyone can, having a son that has died, God forbid, for anybody. I think sometimes it's really important for the nation, more important than worrying about if the other side misinterprets the situation, because I don't think they misinterpret anything. I think they clearly understand what's going on, but their spin on everything, no matter what it may be, is so off the charts, is so unusually grandiose that even sometimes their own people don't buy into their spin on whatever the situation may be.
Well, it's also true that in order to have established what we established here required a certain amount of sentimentality towards the old days, towards the Tanakh, towards this land is the land of our forefathers and so on and so forth. So I think really what it is a balance between that kind of sentimentality and another part that has an edge to it, a hard edge, which makes difficult decisions and goes through with them. It's like what they talk about in the Army, where a unit that's part of the Army mythology and training is that when a unit gets an assignment, it accomplishes it. Now, we also know that there are instances in where commanders suddenly lose radio contact with headquarters when the assignment is one that the officer in the field feels is not worth the sacrifice. But in most cases, there were a lot of hard decisions made, and that's why, in spite of it all, Lamrot Hakol, we have a state. This softness in the wrong places. I mean, it's like in personal relationships. You know, there's a place near where you have to be soft and giving and accepting and loving, even when you don't necessarily feel like it. And there are also places where, for your own selfness, you have to draw a line. You know that with children. They get away with all kinds of stuff, and at a certain point you say, no, you can't just keep doing this, and you have to stick to that. And it doesn't stand by itself. I mean, it stands with this absurd situation in which we have a prime minister who most of the country is disgusted with but can't get rid of because of the intricacies and the bizarreness of the political system, which none of the politicians want to change because that's how come they're sitting pretty where they are. Yet if it's not changed, it just perpetuates itself. They used to say, HaTovim Latayis, the best of the best went into to pilot, to be Air Force pilots, because that was the most challenging position and thought of as one of the more important positions. And at one time, the best went into politics, went into to doing the kind of things that developed the country and that kept the country going and that were good for the country. And now the best go into high tech, and the people who go into politics, by and large, with probably some exceptions, although I'm not sure who they would be, are not the best. Are incompetent and self-serving.
Yeah, second rate. I'm more inclined to. Certainly a disappointment. No leadership here. Lots of politicians, but no leadership. I'm hoping, though, with the change in the election laws and the possibility of at least partial direct representation, which will, of course, eliminate or minimize some of the minority parties that have essentially held the government hostage for money and position, power. Will diminish just by naturally because of direct representation, and hopefully we'll get a better responsibility of the politician to the constituency, otherwise their history. And I'm hoping that will help precipitate maybe some new leadership. I'm hoping that the military and their changes that they've supposedly instituted will not allow for this situation to occur again. Listen, we all make mistakes. You need one mistake, and we have a hostage situation. But I think we can't be complacent. I think we have to be diligent, and we have to do everything in our power to prevent this from taking place again. And I think from what I've been hearing, some of the soldiers have actually been writing declarations stating that if, God forbid, they are captured and they die or their bodies have been captured, not to negotiate for release of prisoners for their bodies. That's a new phenomenon taking place, but at least it's giving warning to the government that they don't want to be used as for hostage purposes, especially if they have died in the course of battle. So I think we have to put that to bed because I think, like you said, I think the two soldiers, Regev and Goldwasser, and Shalit, I think they come from a situation that needs to be completed by us and then a new direction in terms of how we want to handle this in the future.
Well, I think one of the problems in that almost, in a sense, it casts aside whatever the soldiers' wishes are, is that our government, maybe the word should be plural, our governments, but certainly this government, did not make the minimum effort to gain proof that the men were alive, which didn't require, you know, a genius. It didn't require really, some outstanding act. And part of that is because I have a feeling that they don't understand that we're not the only ones who need something, that our adversaries are also have their needs and that we can play that game. And I don't understand where the Jewish cup went, where the Jewish seichel went, in that we didn't make our own demands, because one of Nasrallah's great gains, and I belong somehow, and I'm not sure how this happened, to the largest English language Pakistani website, and I read, you know, every day what these people are saying. And part of Nasrallah's greatness in their eyes is that he made a promise that he would bring Kuntar back, and he fulfilled that promise. So the opposite works. So what it tells me is that he is under his own pressure to bring Qatar back, to make a deal. And therefore, you know, when you're dealing, when you're horse trading, so to speak, and you realize that the other person also has needs and you can work at that and you can challenge him on that level, then you do that. And the degree to which the government, and I think it's part of the sickness that Olmert represents and that the government's, you know, just seems to be totally willing to play along with, is not to make waves, not to have an election, not to make a categorical statement, not to stand, you know, strong and focused on a position, and you bargain on it, and I mean, it's not my style as a person either, but I'm not the government. I'm not responsible for what, you know, the incredible thing that the governments in Israel are responsible for.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you brought up the fact that they felt Nasrallah fulfilled a pledge. And in fact, though, when Kuntar was interviewed in Al-Manar, he said that he was jealous of the Zionists, that he felt that they were willing to relentlessly fight for bringing back their soldiers, whether they were alive or dead, and that he implied that, in fact, he could have rotted in jail for another 30 years and no one would have really cared. So I think maybe some people do believe that Nasrallah actually fulfilled his promise, which he did. Kunta was released. But from Kunta's point of view, it was the relentless desire on part of the Israelis to get their people back, which he had admired, that really got him released, and not Nasrallah as such.
Well, I'm certainly glad to have Samir Kuntar on our side and admiring us, and hopefully he'll vote, for the right prime minister and for the right party, because we still don't get to vote for prime minister. It obviously is. It's very complex, and the different levels and the different waves that are going on and who's getting what and who's pushing where are incredibly intricate. I'm obviously speaking from the position of somebody who's on the outer edge, just reading what most everybody else reads. I don't know anybody that nobody else knows who knows more than anybody else. You know, it's not like some great insight. But these Pakistanis I find interesting because they're writing to each other. I mean, the fact that I'm on the list doesn't faze them in the least. And a certain amount of what they write I can't even understand because it's Arabic written in English, like we would write Hebrew written in English. But I think that I'm getting some kind of an authentic feeling of what a large community of Muslims, non-Arab Muslims, think and function from. And they are, and they see themselves as our adversary. And there's also a fair amount of that on about who the Jews are and the dogs and the pigs and all this stuff. It doesn't fill me with pride, but, you know, a good feeling about who I am, who we are in that context. And I think that's important for us. I think this is a country that needs that, and sometimes it overdoes it, in order to maintain its balance and in order to be able to move forward.
You mean you're talking about self-respect?
Self-respect and self-honor. And there's a point at which, you know, if the government doesn't respect me, us, and I've got all kinds of personal reasons myself for having a little less respect, then I think that it's very serious. It really is not helpful, considering all the other issues and forces that are at play in the neighborhood.
I think the fact that the two families were extraordinarily gracious to the rest of the nation and really made an effort to thank everybody, first for their support throughout the years to get the soldiers back, and second, for the country to support them, even knowing pretty sure that they were no longer alive, and still support the return of the bodies, even if there was that last-minute hope that Nasrallah played games with. Brutal, disgusting, the manipulation of the emotions of the families and trying to instill hope when there was none to begin with. Aside from that, they truly allowed that healing to take place. All of us together, in a sense, felt healed by the fact that we took care of business. And in spite of the fact that maybe it wasn't the best thing for us to do, we needed to do it anyway, if that can be appreciated.
One of the things that most impressed me after the exchange, at the funeral, when Mrs. Goldwasser spoke, she expressed such a kind of a fundamental and very real and very and not boastful kind of Zionist ethic and she was speaking in the name, as not only was she speaking to her husband, she was speaking also in his name and speaking his thoughts that they had shared together, was very moving and very meaningful. It's done. It's over. The question on so many levels and in so many places and in so many parts of our lives is not only what did we do in this case, was it right, was it wrong, but what did we learn? And what can we learn? How can we absorb and use what we've learned so that things are better the next time, or things are not as bad at least? And hopefully that some of that will take place. Hopefully some of the results of this nightmare with Olmert will be that we will learn, and maybe we'll get some politicians who really have some quality and some belief and not just self-aggrandizement in their portfolio.
I sure hope so. We're not finished yet. We still have Shalit. But miserable initiated war to begin with, in the fact that it wasn't thought out. It wasn't planned well. Complacency and arrogance, inexperience was so in the forefront that we lost our self-respect and edge that if we're going to war, then go to war. Do what needs to be done to eliminate the enemy. Otherwise, don't do it, because it creates more havoc, more misunderstanding, and more opportunity for your enemy to say, ah, not only did you lose the war, which we did not, but just the fact that they can say that because they're still standing is enough to provoke the possibility where we're at this moment in time and create another situation that's going to be far worse, because there's not going to be 1,200 Lebanese that will die if we have another war. Like I said previously off mic, we're talking about maybe 120,000 if need be in order to end the war with Hezbollah. And none of us, certainly I don't want it to come to that. But I really believe this next one, if it does happen and Hezbollah provokes it, will be a war that Lebanon most probably will never recover from for 100 years. That's my feeling. The fact is, though, that I think because of the way this thing ended, because of the way this war was developed and never really developed into anything that we had a clear understanding as to what we want to accomplish, as far as I'm concerned, I created a misunderstanding and a miscue that will create possibly a future scenario that will be far, far worse than anybody could imagine.
And unfortunately, we're moving all too rapidly in that direction as we hear that we signed a contract with the United Nations and with Lebanon and with Hezbollah. The contract has been violated incredibly, and there's now three times as many missiles in Lebanon aimed at us as there was before the war. And I think you're right. I think the next war that's being prepared for is going to be worse than the previous war, and that seems to be the process, in part because, I mean, there's so many reasons, but part of it has to do with a kind of a liberal, well-meaning, you know, let's not rock the boat, let's not make any trouble, which we saw after the withdrawal from Lebanon. I mean, originally the idea was that we're withdrawing. You know, if you remember, when we withdrew from Lebanon, one of the great and grandiose statements we made was that they have to honor our withdrawal, and if they don't, then we're going to come get them, right? And it's just by happenstance is the same thing we said about Gaza. Well, all right, we're going to get out. Men, women, children, tanks, trucks, tractors, the works, nothing left. But what happens if they keep attacking us? Well, you know, we're not going to put up with it. But we put up with it in Lebanon, and we put up with it in Gaza. And we still haven't paid the full fare in Gaza. And one of the other things about the poor showing of this prisoner exchange with Hezbollah is that it's just going to make the Shalit business much harder, because Hamas looks at it and says, well, look what they got. Can I do any worse? Can I allow myself to do worse? And then we're going to compound it, because one of the people they're going to demand is Marwan Barghouti, who was the hero of Fatah. And for Hamas to have been the one to get Barghouti out, I mean, you know, it's like compounding the compound, where if we had any seichel, we would let Fatah get Barghouti out. He's going to get out, you know. We might as well let the good guys, or the better guys — there are no good guys — but the better guys get the credit, rather than let it go down in the worst possible way. But my suspicion is we will let it go down in the worst possible way, because we don't seem to be able to form, to condense into a form who we are and what's going on around us and what it is we need to do and where we need to stand firm and where we need to be more giving. And that's, you know, again, something that we face as individuals in our relationships. At what point do you draw a border? Do you draw a line and you say, you know, this far and no further, you can't keep pushing me? And how do we relate that to wanting, you know, our impulse to be loving and to be accepting and to accept and to love? And it's not necessarily an easy line, but it's something that we grapple with as individuals, and we have to grapple with as a nation.
And we grapple with that more so than not after having given up all of the land in Gaza, because the European Union and the European nations, instead of clearly and openly and forcefully saying, yes, you did withdraw, and there are borders, and when they're lobbing Qassams over and they're terrifying and killing people, men, women, and children, enough is enough, that we have a border and you have a right to protect your border and do whatever is necessary. But no. The poor Palestinians, the Gazans, are suffering there. Open up the borders. Allow them to come in. Allow this to go out. But there's always more and more excuses. Well, you send electricity and you supply this, so it's like a prison. All of this stuff, instead of coming and making a stand, because they are spineless in the EU. Their understanding is not to take a stand. They've been traumatized by war so badly that they can't take a stand, because they're so full of guilt from their colonial days that they can't see the writing on the wall, and they never will. And besides, it's only the Jews, right? It's only a Jewish country that most probably shouldn't have been here to begin with. That's why I agree. We have to be tough. We have to be strong. We have to be right in the way we do things, and morally right in the way we do things, and then say to them, no, this is it. This is our gvul. This is our red line. We're not going any further until there is something changed on the other side. And if it's real clear that we're not going anywhere, and that it's really clear that we have, and the reasons why, our ability to educate and share, whether people agree or not is immaterial, but it's out there, then I think they will capitulate. You know, when Blair all of a sudden is Santa Claus now, and he's going to, and he says that Israel should, you know, stop its settlements, but we're going to pour more money after bad into Gaza. I mean, where is he coming from? What kind of message can he possibly be sending to terrorists, that we're going to give you more money in order for you not to do what you're going to do, but we're going to feel okay about it, and then we can say, well, we did it, and you still are attempting to destroy Israel, but then again, Israel's the real culprit because they're not giving you an opportunity to breathe. I mean, if this isn't convoluted doublespeak and spin, I don't know what it is. And it always seems to take place. So therefore, I agree that we need to be firm and we need to be strong and we have to be real clear as to what our red line is, and we have to adhere to it. We can't keep edging closer and closer to their position because of the pressure that may hold. And it is a lot of pressure, economic pressure, the threat of boycott, the threat of this, the threat of that, but our survival's at stake. And what are we willing to give up to the point where we no longer have a chance at surviving? I sure hope not. And that's when we need strong leadership, and we don't have that right now.
All right, Steve, let's go fix it.
Well, we sure have to share it here in order to make some sense of it for us, and hopefully for those folks out there who are listening, as to what we see and what we perceive as a real serious dilemma that's taking place here, in a country that we really love dearly, and that we're here with all our hearts and minds and souls and bodies. We're demanding change. We're demanding leadership, and hopefully we'll get it sooner than later.
Amen.
So from Tel Aviv, this is Steve.
And Yoram.
And Shavua Tov. Have a great week.